Love, CKUT.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on December 10th, 2020. On tonight's show, my guests include Lisa Rubin, Artistic and Executive Director at The Seagull, on the theater's virtual show Underneath the Lintel this weekend.
You know, in the first few minutes, he's going to say, like, this is it, this is all who can be here. You know, of course, the virtual audience, we hope to have hundreds, but in the actual room, we'll just really be the crew.
Rachel Matumbo, actress and writer, the winner of the Kevin Prize from Infinitheater's Write on Cue competition.
I was actually brushing my teeth. I will not forget because Guy's phone number popped up and I was like, in my head, I was like, I wonder what this is about. And I didn't even like make the connection.
Kathleen Stavert and Joy Ross Jones of Artista, with a meta nod under its belt, the mentorship program looks for aspiring theater artists for its 2021 session.
It can be many different things. It can be, I need to be a part of this program because I need to become an artist and I need that support from the mentors to do that. Or it can be, I can't afford another program elsewhere. This is the program for me because it's free. Or I've just arrived in Montreal and I need to meet people.
But before we begin, a few updates. Last week, the National Arts Center revealed it is sharing the stage with Black Theatre Workshop to launch a new form of collaborative curation to bring Black perspectives to the National Four. The NAC will evenly split its English programming resources for the 2021-2022 season, giving BTW access to its resources, funds, and staffing. BTW will also have a say in deciding which Black theater company will follow it the following season. This is a wonderful platform and opportunity coming just as the theater company celebrates its 50th year. I spoke with Quincy Armorer, artistic director, a few weeks back. BTW was actually supposed to present its Sal Capone musical piece at the NAC in the spring, but that has been on hold because of the pandemic. So perhaps it'll be part of the following season. And Centaur Theatre revealed plans for its 24th edition of the Wildside Festival, which will be online this January from the 11th to the 23rd. Associate artist Rose Plotek is back again to curate the fest, which aims this year to support local artists at this challenging time. I'll be looking into the full programming in the weeks ahead, but one of the projects is a sci-fi audio tour of Centaur's physical space and future. Part of the festival will also include a feature called Catalyst at Centaur, which will excerpt various works in progress by local artists of different disciplines. More at centaurtheatre.com. And lastly, some big news in the ongoing pandemic, the thing keeping many theaters closed around the globe. The first person to receive the Pfizer vaccine outside of clinical trials was a grandmother in the UK named Margaret Keenan in London. And the second was one William Shakespeare, who is from the actual bard's home county. Very fitting. Pfizer's vaccine was actually approved by Health Canada yesterday. Doses will be in the country by this Monday, possibly being injected into Canadian arms by Tuesday. Oh, and a comment I saw on Twitter this week made me laugh. Have stage managers handle the vaccinations. Everything will be done calmly, on time, and without any tears. Yes, hopefully indeed. One of the virtual shows I treated myself to this fall was Zebrina, presented at the Théâtre du Nouveau Monde. It is the French adaptation of Underneath the Lintel by American writer Glenn Berger. It was early enough in the season that the show was able to have live, distanced audience members, as well as viewers back home like myself. This was before theaters were closed by government restrictions. Now, this is a co-production between TNM and the Seagull Center, so after the French run, the show is now getting its English run, but entirely virtual as theaters are now still shuttered. It's an apt comparison to the show itself. which begins with an older librarian walking onto a stage that is described in the script as between shows. Ostensibly, it's meant to be just a plain conference room or a community auditorium. Peering into the audience, the librarian asks, "Is this everyone? Should we wait a bit longer?" Then he launches into a story about how he received a very late book to his library in a small Dutch town. 113 years old, within the book, a beat-up travel guide, there's a clue, a slightly less older dry-cleaning ticket. The librarian's quest for this mystery leads him on a journey around the world, and as he relays his story to the audience, this drab conference space turns into a true theatrical environment, and that moment as today many theaters are dark and no one is there. You can still reserve your showing for this coming weekend. There is one stream on Saturday night and two on Sunday. Lisa Rubin is artistic and executive director at the Siegel Center, and she joined me to explain how the collaboration came together for Underneath the Lintel, as well as preparations for the virtual staging. Lisa joined me earlier this week. Hello, Lisa. Welcome back to Upstage. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so happy to have you with us and very excited for this weekend's presentation of Underneath the Lintel. I wanted to go into the backstory about how the Siegel Center came to collaborate with Théâtre du Nouveau Monde, two very storied theater companies collaborating for the first time.
Yes, it was, you know, when preparation meets opportunity. I think we've been wanting to work together for so long, but the timelines of the French and the English theaters don't always line up, and, you know, we work with different unions quite often, so it just hasn't worked out in the past, and lo and behold, it took a pandemic to bring us together, but really, it was director François Girard who fell in love with the script because he found that it was just so appropriate to an awakening of a dark theater, and he brought it forth to Lorraine Pintal, the artistic director of Théâtre du Nouveau Monde. And then we happen to have a mutual friend, Elaine Normandeau, who does a lot of work at the Siegel Center and who is also working on the French production. And she was like, she played matchmaker in this case and said, you need to talk to the Siegel Center. Of course, it, you know, it resonates with us as so much about The Wandering Jew comes up, and, you know, they needed some Yiddish advice, and so it was just like a match made in heaven, and it all happened very fast. It was all very easy. You know, no one had like 100 other projects going on. So yeah, it was just, you know, like hit that easy button in a way, but it was like several years in the making.
That is so fascinating to know that Elaine was the, you call it matchmaker, I'm thinking linchpin. She's the assistant director and stage manager on the production. It's funny because we hear about this project, collaboration. Those are big words, big projects, but sometimes it almost like comes down to one person who has a light bulb and goes, "Ah, I'm going to connect so and so with so and so."
That is, you know, they say it's who you know. I mean, I think in any industry, it's who you know, but it's who you know and it's the relationships that you build. So, you know, so many people can bring projects forward to you, and you don't pay attention to all of them, right? It does depend on who you know, who you've worked with before, and you know, of course, often it really is just about the work itself, but, and in this case, I happen to have loved the script, and it's been on my wish list for quite some time, so it was, you know, I didn't even have to think twice about it, but yes, it is, you know, it is often that, Sarah, as you said, it's just, you know, people making connections.
You just touched on the director, François Girard, who fell in love with the play and kind of, you know, it premiered in 2001, which is almost 20 years ago. But for him, he was thinking of, in the moment of this pandemic, a one-man show, reviving the theater. So we understand where François was coming from. And I'm curious about you. And what you saw in the play, you just mentioned it was on like your long-term wish list. What do you get out of Underneath the Lintel? What do you see there?
Well, when I read so many scripts, and every now and then you come across one of them that, or, you know, that you can't stop thinking about. It doesn't happen very often. Bad Jews is a great example of a script I, like, hugged to my chest. I couldn't get enough of it, and I just want to tell the world about it. And underneath, but when you read a lot of scripts, you know, you it's easy to just sometimes not even get through them. But with Underneath the Lintel, it was in my first year on the job, and I read it, and I was just like, there's something really, really interesting about this story. Why was this so good? Why do I want to know more? Why am I all of a sudden thinking about this and that and imagining a performer bringing these words to life? It's not, you know, it's not so deep that you're going to get lost in it, and, you know, it's just good. It's just like, I guess I read a lot of plays, and this one was good, and it lived on in my memory, so that when it came up again, I was like, oh yeah, that was a good one. Now I'm gonna go back and read it, and yeah, you can't put it down. Sarah, you read it, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Did you read it all in one sitting?
Just about. It does go very quickly, and I kept turning back the pages to say, wait, how can this be moving along so quickly? What were we doing 2 pages ago? Like, how does this move at such a quick clip?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if you really go back and peel off the layers, you know, there's a lot to discover about the librarian and his own journey as he's on the journey to discover, you know, who returned this book 133 years later. It's kind of like stop art, right? Like, you kind of need to see it a few times or read it a few times, and then you really get into it. But I read it once, and I was like, that's good, and I see why it was recommended to me in the first place.
Yeah.
Because that's how I got it in the first place. Somebody saw it and said, I need to look into this play. They had an amazing experience seeing it. That's how it goes, right? Word of mouth. So
I also feel like there's so many details in it, and I would liken it to, I'll confess, I spend a lot of time on Wikipedia. Like, I will just look up random things in history, and then before I know it, I've jumped from, like, a queen in, like, the 18th century, and now I'm on, like, a page about the history of, like, tap dancing. Like, how did that happen? I know there is an expression for it, but, like, the journey that you can make on Wikipedia, clicking on all the links, whatever catches your fancy. That's how I felt like when I was reading it, and it crams so much little,
that's
so many
fun.
If you like trivia and you like details, I think that it's really powerful for that. And when you're talking about seeing it again, getting into it, it's for sure a show that bears rereading and rewatching, because you might miss stuff the first time around.
Yes. Yeah, I totally know what you mean. I love that too. I love being triggered to want to, like, look something up. You know, is this real or did this happen? And with his story, I mean, I guess it really is compelling, because you think, you know, you want to see what he discovers. You want to see, like, you know, does he find what he's looking for? And so we're on that journey with him, and there's something special about that. And of course, like, when you make the comparison to 2001 and 9/11, and you know, theaters being dark then and theaters being dark now, that it really does open that first, you know, in the first few minutes, he's going to say, like, this is it, this is all who can be here. You know, of course, the virtual audience, we hope to have hundreds, but in the actual room will just really be the crew and the, you know, the team who made the production happen, and maybe some staff members who are there, who as production support, but it's going to be, you know, fairly empty room for him.
We're speaking with artistic and executive director at the Siegel, Lisa Rubin. Can we talk a bit about how it's going to be set up? Who gets to be in the room? So you have Emmanuel Schwartz playing the role of the librarian. He's on stage. And then, like, who else is there with him? And is this on the main stage at the Siegel?
Yes. So this is on the Sylvan Adams main stage, and it's going to feel like who would be there at any of your technical run-throughs. So who needs to be there, right? the actually maybe even less people because not all the designers will be there. But you're going to have the director who's going to be there to support, Elaine calling the show. You're going to have whoever's running lights, whoever's running video, whoever is running the projections. And then we have a mini, you know, film crew, say, you know, running the live stream, making sure that the feed goes from our camera, you know, correctly into your home. And then I'll be there. And then, you know, maybe a couple of other staff members to support him. But, you know, all of this is done with limited talking, mask wearing, and, you know, under the strictest of safety protocols to ensure that we do this properly. But he will have some good, really good vibes coming to him from the in-house audience, his friends.
The him is Emmanuel Schwartz, an actor. He has been on all the different stages on the French theater side of things, has done some film work as well. And so this is like his debut on the English side. It is his debut at the Siegel, certainly, as well. Can you speak a little bit about what it's like to this melding of French-English theater in this moment?
Mm-hmm. It's so cool. Like, if you're in the biz, if you're behind the scenes, like, it is pretty special to have such a stellar French team, because the entire team that often works with François Girard as the director, they just need to take a look at their resume to see the unbelievable years of experience they have working on both film and television. And here they are, you know, working on this one-person show in our theater and having the best time. I mean, this is what whether it's a one-person show or 50-person opera or, you know, a $20 million film set, it's still the story and it's still, you know, making something for an audience. Emmanuel, like, I didn't know. I just learned that he grew up in NDG. I did not know that. And it's really interesting to think of the fact he's never performed in English when he has such a full resume in French. And I hope for him that this will give him a bit of exposure and maybe give him like a new avenue in his career to do more work in English. It's great.
I agree completely. You hinted at just a couple of minutes back about the September 11th attacks and how that plays into the origin story of Underneath the Lintel. Can you just tell us that story briefly about how the debut of the show off-Broadway coincided with this?
Yeah, well, it was scheduled to open off-Broadway just as September 11th happened. And they had a shorter shutdown than the pandemic, but still, you know, all of New York and, of course, theaters off and on Broadway shut down. And as it was a world premiere, Len Berger, the playwright, he really took that into consideration, I think, when he finally premiered the play, to make it really relevant and really of the moment, that this is an awakening of a theater and this play and this lecture that the librarian is giving is coming at a time where theaters have been dark. And so the parallels are, of course, striking, and the play is extremely relevant today, you know, because of that, because our theaters have been dark too.
Lisa, will you be watching this weekend at the Siegel or from home?
I will be at the Siegel. I will be at the Siegel, you know, I'm part of the team, so, you know, it's legal, and as long as I feel healthy and, again, wear my mask, I will be there. I want to give as much energy to Emmanuel on that stage as possible, and I want to be there to say hello to everybody watching from home.
So I'll see you on stage on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, yes. We're still working that part out,
okay.
Whether I'm doing a speech or not and all that. But, you know, if all goes well, yes, you will.
Something to look forward to. Thank you so much for speaking about Underneath the Lintel with me. It's much appreciated, Lisa.
thank you for covering it and for taking an interest, and I hope you have a good time.
That was Lisa Rubin, Artistic and Executive Director at The Seagull. Underneath the Lintel stars Emmanuel Schwartz, Saturday at 8 o'clock, and two more showings Sunday afternoon and evening. SeagullCenter.org. It's $18 for an individual ticket and $36 for a household. And if you head to The Seagull's Facebook and YouTube pages, you can see a discussion I led with key players from the show, including the actor Emmanuel, director François Girard, stage manager Hélène Normandeau, set designer Claude Séguin, and even the playwright Glenn Berger, who joined us from his home in the Hudson Valley. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, a fantastic opportunity for young women who want to get into theater. Artista looks to 2021 with a new prize under its belt. Rachel Matumbo was born in Toronto, but grew up in Montreal with her Congolese Canadian parents. She went to John Abbott Theatre School, as well as the National Theatre School downtown, and eventually relocated back to Toronto, where she is now working as a Dora Award-winning actress. But like many, the slowdown of the pandemic afforded Rachel an opportunity where others dried up, the chance to really sit down and pursue a longtime interest, writing. As you will soon hear, she was doing something relatively every day when she got a phone call informing her that she was the 13th winner of the Write on Cue Playwriting Contest, supported by Infinitheater. And it's for her first ever completed play, Vierge. Informally, first place win is called the Kevin Prize, named for longtime supporter and filmmaker Kevin Tierney. And Rachel beat out 40 or so other submissions. It comes with a cool $5,000 and newfound encouragement for her work. Her coming-of-age story was partly inspired by her family. I reached Rachel earlier this week. Hello, Rachel. Welcome to Upstage. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And a very big congratulations on winning this prize. Where were you actually when you got the call?
I was actually brushing my teeth. I will not forget because Guy's phone number popped up, and I was like, in my head, I was like, I wonder what this is about. And I didn't even like make the connection. Like in my head, I was just like, oh, I wonder why I'm getting a call from Infinite Theater right now. It wasn't even like, oh, it's the award you applied for, Rachel. Yes, I literally like just put down my toothbrush and I was like, hello, like, and very like casual. Even as he started, I was like, where's he going with this? Like, I feel like it took me a while to catch up to what was going on. That morning, it was definitely before my morning coffee. So, yeah.
I love that. But you know what? I don't blame you, right? Because you apply for these things and you're probably applying for grants and projects and doing auditions, right? And a couple of weeks, maybe even months go by. I think the deadline for this was late August, if I'm hearing correctly. So, of course, these things pass out of your mind, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like sometimes it really does feel like that. It feels like you throw, you know, a million things at a wall and you try and see what sticks. Like sometimes the life of an artist is that, is just trying to figure out like how many opportunities can I get going and how can I make things happen for myself. And because there are those delays between like when you apply for something and when you hear back, like sometimes it is that. Like it really was that for me. I think I had actually submitted early. So I think I submitted like in July or something like that. And so by the time that the call came back around, it was like, I think also it comes from a place of like nervousness. Like I don't want to like get my hopes up, you know. And I'm just like, it must be nothing. It's probably just a coincidence that this person is calling me, but in fact, it is good news. So, yeah.
Well, what has been the reaction from your family and your friends?
Yeah, it's been really, really supportive. I'm super fortunate to have a community of people like friends, family, like peers, everything who just really have my back when I try different things. Like this play is the first full-length play that I've written, and I wrote it. I finished it earlier this year. So to go from even just the day where I was like, I finished my draft, everyone's like, yay! Like, you know what I mean? So like a few months later, being able to be like, I won this award for it is like huge. You know, so I'm so grateful to have people who are there with me every step of the way.
I'm so glad to hear that, and that you can celebrate them with them as well, at least virtually, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is actually very incredible because that is your first completed play, and they had a huge number of people applying this year, I think for over 40. And so you would be up against people who have been writing plays for decades, other people who we could say are newbies like yourself. So this is really cool to reflect the fact that this is your first full written piece. Let's talk about the development of it. I think you did this with, you had a unit that you were writing with at the Factory Theatre in Toronto. Can you tell me a bit about the early days?
So way back, like a lifetime ago, really at the beginning of this year in January, I found out that I got, way back to the beginning of this year, in January, Factory Theatre got in touch with me and they offered me a spot in their emerging playwrights unit, which is called The Foundry. And it's a really great program that they have there. And it's not a lot of playwrights. I think it's usually like four in our cohort. And you just get a lot of one-on-one time with the artistic director of Factory, who's Nina Lee Aquino. And you get to come up with an idea for a play and develop it. And it was really great because I was there with other playwrights who were in different phases of their careers as well. And so the four of us have a bond, and we have a bond with Nina. And it was really open to be like, here are our ideas on our first day. But Nina was also like, if your play changes, that's okay. As long as you finish your draft, you know, it's okay. But it might not be the play you talked about on the first day. In my case, it was the play that I talked about on the first day, but the crazy thing for me is that, like, I really just kind of had an idea of something, like, some thoughts about an experience that I hadn't written a single thing. And so when we started the unit, we were just doing, like, writing exercises, and we were talking about stuff, and it was, like, really, like, casual and easygoing, and it was great. And then, like, a couple weeks into it, Nina says to us, okay, so for tomorrow's session, like, bring in your first 25 pages. And everyone else was like, oh, yeah, great, yeah, no problem, like, whatever. And I was like, what? I was like, what do you mean 25 pages? Was I supposed to be writing this entire time? Like, I freaked out. Like, I was just like, no, I don't have anything. I can't do it. Like, abort mission. I can't. Like, I was just like, no way. Like, I remember, like, texting my other fellow playwrights and being like, guys, I don't think I'm coming back. Like, I really just freaked out.
So,
and Nina was like, look, like, just write. Start with lights up. The first thing that you see on that stage and write. And I was like, okay. And I did that. And it was really amazing because it made me realize that sometimes as a writer, I hold myself back. And sometimes you can just start with the simplest thing, lights up and go. And that's how I've approached a lot of my work since then. But being able to just know that I can just put it all out there on the page, and that's like, okay, and somehow I will find a narrative and I will find something in that. It's been really rewarding, but that's really how it started. And it was just every time we had more pages due, I was just like, okay, read the last line and just go from there. And I would just keep pushing myself, keep going and going and going. So,
This reminds me a tad of when you're in school and the teacher goes, well, the book report's due tomorrow, and somehow you missed the memo about, like, reading the book or something like that, or haven't even started your document. It's a remarkable story. But I love also that the lesson you took away from it, which is just what your starting point is, lights up, and that's gone on to influence the writing you've done since then.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Rachel Matumbo, who has won the Infinitheatre Write on Cue Prize, the 13th annual prize for her play, Vierge. Now, we've gone so far, we haven't actually talked about what the show is about yet, and I love the themes. We meet four Congolese-Canadian girls, teenagers, and it's a coming-of-age story. The thing is, too, is that they're also talking about marriage, long-term, saving themselves. There's a lot in there. Tell me about these four young women and how you met them.
So I'm Congolese-Canadian. My parents immigrated here shortly before I was born, but I was actually born here. And that duality and that life experience of having a family of immigrants, but myself feeling very Canadian, those things were always, like, confusing to me. And I was just like, am I Canadian? Am I Congolese? Like, as I get older, I'm like, okay, I'm both, but they just mean different things. And I think trying to, like, unpack that experience is kind of where the play began. And that's why the characters are also in different places with their relationship to who they are, whether they feel Congolese or whether they feel Canadian. So there's one character who's born in Canada. There's another set of sisters who just arrived. There's another one who was born in Congo but grew up mostly in Canada. And we see that they have this shared experience of being attached to somewhere else and somewhere else being home, but also trying to find their home here. and sort of the pressures that sometimes can come with a very strong, kind of like very specific cultural background, and integrating that into Canadian society, which is like, you know, for all intents and purposes, is a lot more like liberal and free. But being very traditional and African is often, it feels like very restrictive and religious, but there's also a lot of freedom there as well. And so I think with those characters, I'm trying to show those different sides of that. And and the fun of it really too.
It's fun that you mentioned fun, because one of the notes the jury left was that this play makes you tear up and laugh out loud, sometimes on the same page. Was that something that you consciously were thinking about as you were drafting it?
Yeah, definitely. I think the most fun about being Congolese for me is, I think, how hilarious my family is. I was just with my parents a few weeks ago, and when I saw them, like, I was just, like, laughing so much. And it's not even, like, it's intentional on their part. It's just, I don't know, like, how to explain it, but, like, I feel that the culture brings about a lot of, like, comedy, and laughter to us as a people, I think, is also really important. You know, as much as we take things seriously in our family, like, we also like to laugh about things and have a lot of joy in the house. And so I really wanted to bring that into the play, because I think those dynamics in theater and in life are really important. So I definitely intentionally was like, I want to talk about some serious stuff, and I want to explore, you know, certain dramatic elements and stuff, but I also want people to laugh. Like, I love a play where you can laugh about something, and then you're like, whoa, we're talking about something really deep, too, you know? Like, yeah. I think those things can exist together. And as an actor, too, like, I think it's more fun. Like, even if you're talking about something serious, if you're able to laugh while you're going through it, you know, nothing wrong with plays that are fully dramatic all the time, but I think there's a lot more to experience sometimes when we're able to laugh about things as well.
You just touched on your experience as an actor, Rachel. Can you talk about how that's influenced your writing? And, you know, did you set out, I know you graduated from the John Abbott drama program. I presume you were in the acting stream. Did acting come before writing, or vice versa, or have you always been interested in both?
No, I've always written, and I've always enjoyed writing. Like, even when I was a kid, whether it was short stories or long format essays, poems, I've always just loved writing. But I never really considered it a career move until very recently, which is like a little bit strange, I think. But the fact is, like, when I made a decision that I wanted to be an actor, I never really considered the fact that I enjoyed writing as a hobby and bringing them together. And it's actually been interesting, because I try also to not put pressure on my writing, because I love writing and I never want to lose that. And sometimes when things become career oriented, it becomes about work and not about the experience of it still being like a hobby. So I trained as an actor at John Abbott, and again at the National Theatre School. And those were a few years ago. And the writing thing has really, really just started for me this year, actually. So they kind of, the writing has always been there, but it's definitely sort of married to the acting thing a little bit better now.
Absolutely. Do you feel like winning a prize like this, has this kind of confirmed your interest in writing? Do you feel motivated to write more or to explore different stories?
Like, it really, for me, it really solidifies the fact that I can call myself a playwright. I think a lot of people who know me and I've worked with in the last year, while I'm doing different playwriting things, I'm always just kind of like, oh, I'm an actor who's like trying to write plays. It's always kind of been like I've been a little bit like more timid about it. And it's like, oh yeah, it's sort of something that I do. But definitely winning a prize like this really helped me feel solidified in saying that I am a playwright, and it's just as valid as my acting career. And even if, when it comes to acting, I have, like, you know, training and degrees to hold up next to it, and I don't have that for writing, but I can still say that there are people who believe in me as a writer and see potential for my work. So I think that it's definitely just as valid for me.
Rachel, let's just put it out there, like, no budget, like, unlimited budget, whatever you want. Like, what would be the ideal staging for the premiere of Vierge? Where would you like to see it happen? Do you have any actors that you'd love to see in the role of these four teenagers?
Oh, wow. I haven't thought about it at all. Like, I'm so open to seeing it wherever. In my heart, just like me, I feel like this play has a place in Toronto just as much as Montreal. So I don't, like, I'm not either, like, it has to be here or has to be here for a premiere, either stage. But because of the whole situation with COVID, when that play comes to be on the stage, I just want it to be in a house full of people. Like, mm-hmm. I just want it to be at the point where people can feel free to laugh and enjoy and be in the theater the way that we used to be. I crave that so badly, and I crave that especially for a premiere. But yeah, in terms of like where it happens, I don't know. While I was at Factory, I was in the Foundry, but there's also the Foreman, which is their similar, it's like sort of a parallel program, but for emerging directors. And in that unit, there was an artist, her name is Natasha Mumba. And Natasha and I actually did a show together the year before. And so we already knew each other, but through the program at Factory, Natasha ended up getting paired with me, and she was my director for the workshops of YIF. And that partnership between Natasha and I was so important to me. Natasha is a Zambian artist, and Zambia and Congo actually share a border. So there's so much stuff that is so parallel in our experiences, and so much that we both related to with all the characters, and just the conversations we had were so rich. So in terms of my creative team, the important thing to me is that Natasha be a part of it. I would love for Natasha to direct it, but Natasha's also a phenomenal actor, so if she wanted to be in it as well, that would be great for me. But both in Toronto and in Montreal, there are so many talented African-Canadian actors who would be great for any of these roles. So I look forward to seeing that day when it comes, but yeah,
I have a few in mind already in Montreal that I think would be great fits, having not even read the script or anything. Just, yeah, there's a deep well of talent, absolutely, and just another wonderful opportunity to have people living out these kinds of stories on stage. Rachel, one last question for you. What's happening next? I know you're probably not resting on your laurels for very long. What are the next few months be like for you as an actor and writer?
Yeah, right now as a writer, I'm very fortunate to be very busy right now. So Yale, because I did the emerging unit at Factory, Factory has welcomed me and a few other amazing Canadian playwrights into residency. And so I'll be developing Yale for the next few months, probably until the spring or maybe longer. I'm not sure yet. It depends what the script needs from me. But yeah, so VF will continue to get more development and hopefully get it ready, or closer to being ready for production. And I've also been working on another play. It's called 6x10. There's a theater company in Toronto called Studio 180, and I did an in-development series with them, so I was able to workshop with some other great actors for that. And that will come out, I think it'll be like in an online format in March, I believe, of the new year. And acting-wise, there's not a whole lot for me. I feel like I've had so much on my plate as a writer, and I'm just kind of devoting my time to that. And also just with the way the world is right now, I'm just kind of like going with the flow in terms of everything career-wise right now. But yeah, so right now I'm just really busy writing and enjoying this process. And then who knows?
Has the pandemic kind of forced you to work on your writing?
Yes. Like, definitely. I think prior to the pandemic, I feel like I always had an excuse for like, oh, I don't have time, I'm so busy doing this other thing, and, you know, all this stuff. And then, you know, since March, things have been a lot quieter. So there's no reason for me not to get writing done, which has been, like, a blessing, I think, for me at the end of the day. It's been nice to kind of slow down and to pause. As much as I want to get back to work, like, full force, it's also really great to just enjoy it sometimes. I think we can get so caught up in things when we forget why we're doing them in the first place. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of writing done in the pandemic, and it's been really rewarding to just have this time because, you know, I don't know if I'll ever get it again before retirement, so I'm enjoying it right now.
Rachel, it was such a pleasure to meet you. Congratulations again on winning the Kevin Prize. I'm sure there is so much more that we're going to be hearing from you in the time to come, and that when there is, you'll come back on upstage to tell us about it.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Rachel Matumbo, and a hearty congratulations to her. I hope we can see her winning play, Vierge,
on stage sometime soon. For more information about Rachel and the Write on Cue contest, as well as the second and third place winners, visit infinitheater.com. The deadline to submit for the 2021 Write on Cue contest is Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. If you have questions, call 514-987-1774 or email box-office@infinitheater.com. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. If you or someone you know is keen to get a toehold in the theater world and is female or female identifying or non-binary and between the ages of 16 to 21, I have a free opportunity for you. There's no catch. Artista is a free mentorship program run by Imago Theater, the same company that put together the Eco Anxiety series we learned about a few weeks back. This is also a chance to celebrate the program and what it means for the theater community. 2 weeks ago, it won a prize at the Montreal English Theater Awards, one of the two prizes that are community nominated. It's the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Meta. The committee said the award recognizes the program's, quote, steadfast commitment to offering a safe, creative, non-judgmental space for a group of young artists to find and nurture their creative voice. There is an emphasis on self-exploration and process. This culminates in a public outcome which celebrates the wide range of voices, experiences, and interests among the cohort, end quote. It's like an incubator or greenhouse for talent. Two incredible female artists from the program made time for me. Kathleen Stavert is Artista's program director, and Joy Ross Jones is the associate program director and a past mentor. We spoke earlier this week. Congratulations on the Meadow Nod, the win for the program. How are you guys feeling?
It's really wonderful to have Artista, which has now been in the works for 7 years. By in the works, I mean running annual sessions under the umbrella of Imago Theater's annual activities. It's really wonderful to see the program grow and to have the recognition from the theater community. It's awesome.
Kathleen, what's going through your mind this week?
Well, I just think it's absolutely incredible. This is my first year as program director, so the credit really goes to Joy, who's the instigator of it all. She's the one who created the program and has been running it for the past several years. So I'm just, what's going through my mind is that I'm just extremely honored to be a part of it.
That's wonderful, and it gives so many opportunities to young people. Can you tell me about the kind of artists that you have coming through your doors, metaphorically speaking? Who applies for Artista?
We have all sorts of emerging artists. I can speak to last year because I was a mentor on last year's cohort. We had young women that were involved in theater, involved in sort of more physical theater. We had young women that were visual artists. We also had people who had done sort of quite a bit of community theater and writing in their own free time, and just really wanted to throw themselves a little deeper into the theatrical world. So they really come with a keen interest in theater and creation, and a keen interest also in finding some community in that, because a lot of them also were studying subjects that weren't necessarily theater and art, and were craving that sense of theatrical community. So yeah, they were really from all over, geographically and sort of in their interest.
Yeah, and I'll pick up on that a bit. The young women who applied to Artista are often young women who are already involved in, like, they're already registered in universities or CSHEPs or high school. So it's pretty cool that Artista welcomes from 16 to 21 year olds. We get quite a, we always get the entire age range in each cohort. And it's great to have a 16 year old next to a 21 year old sharing space, sharing creative ideas, and learning from one another, despite, I mean, like the 16 year-old learning from the 21-year-old is not surprising, but it always happens the other way around as well, which is beautiful. And then there are people who have, like, just arrived in Montreal who are looking for that sense of community, who are looking to ground themselves in the city, and Artista is their first step in doing that. One of the things that we look for when we're selecting from the applicant pool each year is diversity of perspective, and that comes with, like Kathleen said, a variety of geographical home locations, a variety of interests, a variety of ages, and then people who identify in different ways on the gender spectrum as well, as long as they feel comfortable in a space that centers the perspectives of women. So I would say Artista welcomes a bit of everything would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just want to harken back to the fact that you don't actually need any experience in theater to apply and to be accepted. So when you have someone like that who's come in and accepted into the program, do they usually end up continuing on to continue in the field or go into a different artistic field? I'm not sure if you can answer to that, if you've seen that, Joy, over the years.
Yeah, we have. There are definitely a few folks in the Montreal English theater community who have gotten cast in productions who were part of the Artista program, and that was part of their process of kind of emerging into the community. But like Kathleen said, they aren't necessarily all in theater to pursue theater. They're coming, so a bunch of them are coming from different fields, and they're looking to get a better handle on their voice, or they're wanting to explore their creativity because they had to let it go in their program. And I find that definitely there are participants who end up finding their home in the Montreal English theater community, and then there are a bunch who take their experience with Artista and the sense of community that they've built, and they use that to bolster them in the other fields that they're in.
That is the voice of Joy Ross-Jones, Associate Program Director at Artista, and we also have Kathleen Stavert on the line, who is the Program Director. You guys both just talked about how important community is, that these are young women or women identifying people who are coming together and they are feeling that sense of connection. What do you do to besides everyone being in the same place and taking part in the same activities, what do you do to help foster that sense of community, to make people feel comfortable about creating and exploring their voices in the same time and space?
I think that one of the ways we do that is that we have mentors following them and encouraging them every year. So each mentor has a group of, say, four participants. So there's a bit more one-on-one time, or at least small group time, where the participant can ask questions, ask for advice, and also can be sort of pushed and encouraged, because I think sometimes mentors have a bit more insight on the artistic world that they're in and can see the potential before the individual sees it sometimes. So there's a nice relationship that's built there. And I think the sensitivity of each mentor on how to approach each participant and really work with their strengths. And also just the way, I think that sensitivity also comes into the entire group aspect as well. We have workshops that we conduct every session. We have invited artists that come in some sessions to just talk about their careers, talk about their own artistic practice, where the participants can ask questions and just really make a connection with that artist. There's also a lot of feedback that's given, and it's not just feedback from the mentors or the program directors. It's feedback from everybody. We encourage the participants to develop an artistic vocabulary that they can then use to construct feedback, constructive criticism, and just be able to their practice and other people's practice to kind of have that specific eye on things, if that makes sense.
It's like they're learning the language. They're learning the lingo.
Yeah.
And I'll add to that that I think in that environment where we have all these artists coming in, always what's centered is the stories. So if they're a dinner guest or a guest workshop leader or a participant, we're always asking how they got to where they are, what story do they want to tell, especially when it comes to the participants. I think that's something that fosters trust and brings the participants and the mentors together on day one, is that we get to learn a bit about everybody's story, and in sharing that story, sharing aspirations, sharing fears and insecurities, which sometimes we do delve into on day one. it really fosters trust, and in doing that, you bring people together and you create a sense of community, a group of people who are not going to let go of each other at the end of the program. Friendships are always very enduring after Artista, which is amazing.
That's so beautiful.
I also just want to add that Artista is truly a program where we encourage you to come in with everything that's going on in your life. Like, it's a space, virtual or live, where you can really come with the weight of your day and you can share it. If you feel like it, you don't have to either. But we encourage those stories, like Joy was saying, to really feed through in the creation and also in the conversations that we have. So it's really inviting participants in with everything that they are, and everything that they've got going on around them.
Speaking of, bringing whatever's going on in your life to the table, we are living in very interesting times, in a pandemic. The program runs from the end of January the 25th to May 21st, 2020, so kind of like a winter semester. What are the plans to work together and adapt in the age of COVID-19 for this coming year?
Yeah, Kathleen.
Good question. this is new for us. We did manage to, I think, successfully move online almost overnight in March of 2020. And this year we're polishing that and making it a bit more, I would say, organized, where we will gather virtually, and the program will be focused on text-based creation. So there will be a lot of time and prompts for free writing. A lot of the artists that will be invited in will be playwrights, authors, creators themselves, that will take participants through writing workshops, creation workshops, and that doesn't exclude movement. I think it actually really includes movement, because when we're creating, it's happening with the entire body, right? Like, the entire system is involved. All senses are fired up. So although it is a text-based creation focus this year, it'll really encompass everything from movement to voice, and again, community.
Yeah, that one factor that we keep coming back to is creating a sense of a community and that connection with people. Because we don't produce art in a bubble necessarily, even though some of the work in this field can be solitary. You mentioned writing and I guess brainstorming, but it remains, despite what we're going through, remains a collaborative process. So the applications, I believe, are open until January the 3rd this coming year. I think, Joy, you mentioned a little bit about what you do look for in people who apply. Can we just to talk a tiny bit about what you are looking for from people who want to be in the program?
I can brain fart there, because I'm in between last year's session and this year's session, which I'm a little bit less involved in, because I'm going to do some parenting of my daughter more so than program directing of Artista. But I was involved in putting the application together for this year, so I do know that the program that Kathleen and the mentors, when they're going through applications, they're looking for how you, the applicant, might articulate your story. And I think the most important criteria, I would say, is a sense of need. Why do you need to be in Artista? Why do you need free theater mentorship? And that need can be really, really, it can be many different things. It can be, I need to be a part of this program because I need to become an artist and I need that support from the mentors to do that. Or it can be, I can't afford another program elsewhere. This is the program for me because it's free. Or I've just arrived in Montreal and I need to meet people. I think a combination of being able to tell us a bit about who you are and what you hope to get out of the program, and then simultaneously why you think you need Artista. If you can articulate that well, and that can be through writing, or it can be through poetry, or it can be through video. There are many different ways that you can submit that information to the program. Having those stories come out, being able to articulate those two things, that's what the application is geared towards.
I want to leave it again on the notes about last week's win at the Metas. We just talked about this at the opening, but any parting thoughts about what it means to get that kind of recognition for this program that has been, working these past couple of years, churning out upcoming artists, but to have that kind of recognition from the greater community?
Super exciting. It's great to get an award, but I think it's also needed to have equity, diversity, inclusivity across the board. And just because there's an award doesn't mean that the work is done. Yeah, that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, I think it bolsters, having an award next to Artista's name bolsters the work that the program does. And it allows for the program to advocate for itself more strongly when it comes to funding and getting people's attention. Unfortunately, we do celebrate accolades. We love those little laurel leaves next to our name. So I think that's, it's really great to have the acknowledgement from the community. And there's so much work to do, like Kathleen said, so having that acknowledgement, I think will hopefully allow the program to be even farther reaching. That would be my goal. That would be my hope.
Awesome. So people can apply until January the 3rd, and I will get that information into just the tail end of the interview after we come off this. Thank you so much, Kathleen and Joy, for taking some time to talk about this. You're doing amazing work, and I look forward to hearing about the next crop, the 2021 crop of Artista participants. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
That was Kathleen Stavert, Program Director, and Joy Ross Jones, Associate Program Director. For more information on Artista and how to apply, visit imagotheater.ca. The deadline is Sunday, January 3rd, and the session starts January 25th and runs until May 21st, 2021. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Lisa Rubin, Artistic and Executive Director at The Siegel, Rachel Matumbo, actress and writer, the winner of the Kevin Prize from Infinitheater's Right on Cue contest, and Kathleen Stavert and Joy Ross Jones of Artista. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Until next time, stay home and stay safe.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada. CKUT.
The COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands,
wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
Hey everybody, Derek Seguin here. So we won't be hosting our families for the holidays this year, but let's look on the bright side. Got an aunt with some zany theories? Just mute her on the family video calls. A hippie cousin that bring new wave sludge to Réveillon? Not this year. To protect your family's health and safety, it's important you stay home and enjoy the peace and quiet.
Welcome to the December 10th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight we have a lecture by Noam Chomsky entitled Class Struggle or Get It in the Neck. It was recorded in Oro Valley, Arizona on November 30th of this year. It's brought to us through the kind graces of Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. At the end of tonight's show, we'll give you all the information so you can obtain a copy of tonight's show or a transcript of it. So here's tonight's lecture, Noam Chomsky, Class Struggle or Get It in the Neck.
So there's been this massive robbery of the population for 40 years and has its effects on the way the government works. That's why you end up with, say, 90% of the population being basically unrepresented. And these struggles go on constantly. They're going to go on in the post-pandemic world. It's a radical class struggle, but only one element in the struggle is always fighting, the business world. They're dedicated. They never stop unless working people, general population, take part in the class struggle. They're going to get it in the neck.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on class struggle or get it in the neck. The ruling class, and there is such a thing, assiduously attends to its needs. That is to say, to maintain and expand its power and wealth. How does it do that? By manipulation, propaganda, and political influence.